You know you've got a comeback in you. When you take the next step, you're going to make it count. For your career, for your family, for your life. You can earn a degree you're proud of with Purdue Global. Purdue Global is backed by Purdue University, one of the nation's most respected and innovative public universities. This is your chance. This is your opportunity. This is your comeback. Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
It was a really great shoot until the old man, he collapsed on the cross. And it was really heavy, and they had to get the ambulance in. And they thought they were arriving at a snuff scene.
Yeah, it was weird coming to that set with a cross and all that.
Evening, everyone. Welcome to Midnight Chats, the music interview podcast for late night listening. My name is Greg Cochran.
I'm Stuart Stubbs.
And Stu, tonight's guest on the podcast is someone who has had a distinguished career, is putting it a little bit lightly, really. Do you want to have a go at trying to sum up our guest's kind of contribution and what you spoke to them about?
Yeah, there's a lot to get into with Anton Corbijn. A bit different for us, actually. Not a musician, a photographer and a filmmaker who has played such a huge role in music since he started his career as a photographer in 1979. He's from Holland. The Netherlands, sorry, he's from the Netherlands. He moved to London in 1979, started shooting for the enemy. He ended up taking some very famous photos of Joy Division in Bayswater Tube Station. And that put him on this path of shooting legends after legend after legend within music. He worked very closely with Depeche Mode and U2. He became creative director for their visual outputs. Anton's the guy that shot the cover of the Joshua Tree by U2. He then started directing music videos, including loads of Depeche Modes. He's the guy that made Enjoy the Silence for Depeche Mode. He made Heart-Shaped Box, Greg, for Nirvana.
Yeah, I mean, it's like insanely iconic Anton Corbijn's work. And the great stories about Kurt Cobain in this, by the way.
What he's done, every time you think, oh, that would be quite a good career if it ended there, then it's like another thing. Mm. He then started making films. He made that incredible Joy Division biopic, well, the Ian Curtis biopic, rather, Control, starring Sam Riley. That then opened a door for him to make a huge Hollywood picture called The American with George Clooney, which we talk about ever so slightly here. I could have spoken to this man forever because I'm a big fan of all of his work. I start off sort of gushing towards him at the beginning. I'd like to apologize to the listeners and to Anton for that. But the reason Anton was in town to speak, we did this face-to-face in the summer of 2023. He was promoting a new documentary film called Squaring the Triangle, which at this point you can see on streaming. I know it was on Netflix and is hopefully still there. It was on a plane I was recently on as well, Greg. Little humble brag for you there. Yeah, it's called Squaring the Triangle, and it's about a legendary 1970s artwork design company called Hypnosis. They are the company that created some of the most ridiculous album covers of the 70s. Worked very closely with Pink Floyd. Dark Side of the Moon is one of theirs. The Man on Fire on Wish You Were Here, that was one of theirs. It's a really great documentary. It's all the stories behind these really elaborate, ridiculous images that ended up on album sleeves for people in the 70s at a time when essentially people were just spending obscene amounts of money on their album art. That's how I managed to get Anton Corbijn to sit in a room with me, basically. He's a legend. He's an absolute legend in the visual side of music from 79 onwards. He's been there for the whole thing.
And also, this is something a little bit different for us. As you said, like, Anton's not a musician, but somebody's like had a legendary contribution to music culture for decades. I wondered, he's quite softly spoken and very like down to earth. And when he delivers a story, he's just like, even about whoever it might be, U2 or the Rolling Stones, he sort of does it in this sort of very quiet, kind of grounded way. I wanted to ask if he was what you were expecting.
It's that very, you know, strong Dutch accent, I think. It's very calming. And it makes him so modest. I think he seems like a very modest guy. And you know what I took away from meeting Anton Corbijn? When I'm 68 years old, if I look half as good as Anton Corbijn, I will be very pleased, very stylishly dressed. As if I've not made it clear already, I liked him.
Like or love?
Love. This is Anton Corbijn, my number one. Here tonight on Midnight Chats. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you for coming onto the podcast.
My pleasure.
I'm a big fan of yours, and actually your work was there right at the start of my career, actually, because when I first left university, my first job was at NME magazine.
Really?
Yeah. And this was 2005, which I was there for 2 years. If I'm not mistaken, I don't think you would photograph him for them at the time I was there. I think you'd left long before.
I left in 85.
Okay, right. Yeah, we just missed each other.
Yeah, by 20 years. Yeah.
But when I got that job, I worked on the photo desk. I was the junior photo researcher and I had no experience in it. And I didn't necessarily even have a huge sort of love for photography, I guess, at that point. But working there, they had this huge archive, this photo archive. So my days would be spent in there looking at lots of old prints, including lots of your old prints. And subsequently, since then, I started my own magazine, and photography's been a huge part of that original photography. So, yeah, you were there from the very... Your name was a name that I sort of became very familiar with very quickly at NME. So you left in 85...
Yeah, and I sued the NME.
Did you?
About 5 years later.
Okay. What did you sue them over? Rights. Rights.
Well, about rights, because I had the rights to my pictures that they had signed that at the time. And they were going to put a book out, yeah, some cheap, you know, rock photography book. And I really didn't want to be part of that. And they went ahead anyway. And I sued them, and they settled, and I was allowed to take all my pictures out of the files. So obviously I missed a few because you found some.
Maybe I'm misremembering this. Maybe the conversation would always be, it's a shame we don't have Anton's pictures.
That would be a better conversation.
I remember that your name was used a lot, though. We you know, your name was, that was how I was introduced to your work and your photos. So when did you start there? And did you start there as soon as you arrived in London?
Yes. I mean, what happened was that in early 79, I went to the NME with some bunch of pictures to show to the then editor, Neil Spencer. And I showed him, and he was really enthusiastic. And he wanted to publish a couple just for the sake of it. And I said, well, if I come to live in England, would you give me some work? And he said, sure, sure. So on that fake promise, I moved to England. And then half a year later, I knocked on the door and I said, here I am. And who are you? And I said, well, you know, you said you would give me some work. I did this picture. Oh, yeah, yeah. So he took me around to the big room where all everybody was working with piles of stuff on people's desk. They're all typing. And he said, this is Anton, and he's a great photographer from the Netherlands. Anybody got some work for him? And you heard, so they were silent, the people looking up from above whatever was on their desk. And one guy started to sing, I hate the fucking Dutch, they live in windmills and their clocks. There was some punk single that I was unaware of, so I took it personal. And then slowly people started to type again, and that was it. That was my introduction to the NME. They couldn't care less. But one guy, Tony Stewart, he called me a week later. He said, oh, there's a gig at the marquee, but Bill Haley, can you photograph that? So it was printed like a poster stamp in the NME, but that was my first commissioned work. And then some photographer got ill who was supposed to photograph Joe Jackson as a feature. And then they called me last minute and I went, and Joe liked my work and the NME liked my work. And suddenly I was doing covers for the NME, and I worked for Joe for a bit, and it was a great time.
Mm. What was your what was your first cover for the NME? Was it a Joe Jackson shot?
No, it was a story by Nick Kent on Rockabilly.
Right.
So it was Rockabilly kids in a club.
Okay.
And then the second one was the week after, was a Selector.
So this is 79 when you sort of arrive in the UK.
Yeah, October 79. And the first cover was in January 80.
I've heard a story from you, I think, on an old film, talking about when you got here, maybe like within 2 weeks, you went to see Joy Division and you introduced yourself to them backstage.
Correct.
And where was that? Where was that show where you saw them?
I think it was the Rainbow.
Which is in Finsbury Park,
yes,
right?
Yes, yeah. I don't think it exists anymore.
No, it's like a big sort of church now.
Yeah, yeah. I saw that the other
day. Was the Rainbow the venue that had a retracting roof? Did it have a roof that, maybe that was in the 60s though. I heard a rumor that it had a roof that could come off to make it an outside venue.
Right, okay. I arrived in October and I saw Joy Division early November, so they wouldn't have the roof off
right,
that
yeah,
time
yeah.
of the year.
Did you come here because of Joy? Like, Joy Division was that part of the reason you came here? Because you loved that band?
Yeah, I loved the music and I wanted to be closer to where that kind of music came from. And I'd been for a Dutch magazine called Or. I'd been a few times to England to photograph for them. And I always loved my pictures so much, the ones I took in England, more than the ones I took in Holland. So I felt it was quite a natural kind of environment for me to shoot in. And then when Unknown Pleasures came out, I thought, well, I just have to go there because it's so fantastic what happens there. I wanted to be part of it. I don't want to wait till people get well known and then come to Holland. So that was they were the main motivators to go there. And I sold myself as an important photographer in the Netherlands, and they hadn't toured the Netherlands yet. So I think Rob Gretton said, okay, I think you should do it. And I had a basement flat in Bayswater, and the only tube station I knew was Lancaster Gate. So I asked them to come to Lancaster Gate, being the only place I kind of knew. And they came on Sunday morning, it was very cold, and they were standing there outside the tube station, shaking with a cigarette in their hand, and underdressed English boys, you know, big coat but nothing underneath it kind of thing. And when I cast Jim Riley, because he was a smoker, he stood outside, same way, you know, it was in the winter, and he stood there trembling. I thought, well, that's a good sign.
What was it like? You mentioned that when you were still living in the Netherlands, but you'd come here and photograph, you liked the way those photos looked more than the ones that you were taking back
yeah.
home. What was it about them? Was it the light, or was it what you were taking photos of?
No, the light is the same as in Holland, really. It's overcast most of the yeah. time. No, it was, I think, partly me, because I was excited about being in England and being where it happens. Mm. And just, I think the surroundings I liked, and I liked people's, determination to get out of the council flats and make something of their life. And they gave everything to the music. And I at the time gave everything to photography. You know, I had no fallback plan. You know, it was all or nothing for me. And I gave photography everything I had. In Holland, I lived for a year in a brothel. Here I lived 6 months in a squat after I got kicked out in Bayswater. I lived in Dalston in a squat. So I was photographing Bowie, you know, that just went on.
Were you always good at it? Did you always get the sense that how old were you when you picked up a camera? And
17.
And did you just know you had an eye for it at
no,
that point? Or were you rubbish?
I just took a camera because I was so shy and I didn't dare to go to a concert where I knew nobody, because I was just moved with my parents to a new city and hadn't gone to school yet. I was on school holiday. And that means that you don't know anybody. And I felt that if I carried the camera, you know, it gave me something that I wouldn't have without it. And this is my father's camera, and I took a few photographs on it. And it was a daylight concert, you know. And I sent them to a magazine just because I didn't know what else to do. And I was so obsessed by music and the music world. And they published a few, and I thought, well, that's it. That's what I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I'm going to take pictures of bands. And, of course, the first year I was at school, and I photographed my father's camera in the provinces of where I was living. And nobody published any of the pictures. And then the next school holiday, I worked in factories to earn my own camera. And then I tried to photograph, and nobody published any of the pictures. But at the end of the second year, the enemy of Holland, if you like, published one of my pictures, small. But I thought, well, that's it, you know. And then I tried to get into the art academies, and nobody would have me. I tried three different ones in Holland. So I'm self-taught, really.
I'm surprised to hear, in a way, that you're shy, because that action of moving to a different country is quite bold. And then when you get there, to go to a gig of Joy and of Joy Division, who are quite an intimidating bunch, or they certainly seemed that from their music and their look and everything. And then to get backstage and say, can I take your photos? That's all of that sort of stuff is quite bold.
Yes, it is.
Confident stuff.
I think the camera helped me, you know, it sort of pushed me forward. Mm. And moved to England, I went with my then girlfriend, who was far better equipped to arrange things than I was. So she found the flat, she found this and that and the other. So alone I couldn't have done it. But yeah, I was driven by something to make contact with people and photograph them. Those, you know, I did everything to be able to photograph people, I think.
Mm. So around that time, I mean, it's the very end of the 70s. So Hypnosis, who the new film is about, I guess it's kind of winding down, isn't it? That ends in 82, doesn't
yes.
it? But were you, so you wouldn't necessarily crossed paths or worked with them, because you were also just starting out, and they were at that point, you know, the kings of graphic design and album artwork. But were you aware of that then? Was that because Hypnosis, actually, to me, I saw the film the other week, by the way, and really enjoyed it. Even to me, it's like a name that I sort of half know now, but didn't really know. But back then, did people know it then? Did photographers know it? Creatives know what Hypnosis were, what they were doing?
I'm sure that everybody knew, because in that world, at least, because there's a lot of books out on Hypnosis. You know, they did this series of books called Album Cover Album, which had a lot of their stuff in it, and they insignated that. I mean, they were Poe, I think, was very clever in his wheeling and dealing, you know. But I wasn't professional proper, you know, so I would never be hired by Hypnosis to photograph anything, and I didn't think of that either. You know, I was wanted to be published in the NME. That was, for me, the highest good, and then record sleeves came secondary. And you didn't even think about exhibitions then.
One of the things that I really loved about the film is this sort of time span, this 70s sort of decade, really, where the rock industry was completely ridiculous. And there was so much money and there was so much excess. And that story that they say in the film about the statue that they put on the top of Everest.
For Paul McCartney,
for the Wings' Greatest Hits. Which they could have probably done anywhere, but they, you know, it was a time of excess, so they did it there because somebody, I think Paul McCartney even said we should put it on Everest. Are you interested in that world? Because I've always felt with your photos and your work that it's all quite understated, and I can't imagine you shooting those sort of covers that Hypnosis were doing, and it's much more sort of simple for you. Is that fair?
Yes, totally. I didn't dream of these things. I'm a very hands-on kind of guy, so I would do it always myself. And I was shooting black and white. I didn't have an assistant till I did the Joshua Tree, I think. That's when that started. So Yeah, I did everything myself, photographed myself, made appointments myself, developed my films, printed my photographs, dropped them off at the enemy or whatever, you know. It was a different time. So I was also from a generation of the punk and the post-punk generation, you know, not of the Pink Floyd generation.
I mean, in terms of that side of the music industry that you walked into, I guess, starting with that meeting with Joy Division and then all the NME stuff, what do you remember from the music business at that point? I was born in 82. And I think for my generation, one of the reasons we think that the past was better than now isn't necessarily the music itself, although obviously some of that is incredible. It's the way things worked and the fact that you could walk up to Joy Division and say, can I take some photos? And they would say yes, and you didn't have to go through channels and labels and lots of people. I suppose that's punk, right? But was it all like that? Was it as easy as I think, as I would like to think and sort of regret missing out on?
I like to think it was easier, yes. I think there was less of an organization protecting everybody, and now it's overprotected. And everything has to be approved and everything, you know. I think what happens now is a lot of people who were young then are older now, and they competing to kids who are 15 or 16 and looking so young. So that's difficult to not be retouched, as it were, you know, in the photographs. And complete control is the whole idea of them. And as a photographer, you also want complete control over your work. So that's a flash point.
You mentioned that you, for a long time, didn't have an assistant. You'd travel just you and your camera, which I imagine was part of the appeal for lots of people, that they knew you were like an unfussy guy, especially for the punks.
Yeah, I think it's different if you appear on somebody's doorstep on your own, or with three assistants and lights. You know, it must be different. It must be more invasive, I think, with a big group. And I never felt home with lighting things and all that stuff.
Yeah. Do you ever have rules that you put in place to the people you're shooting? The reason I say that is because I heard a story. Obviously, this is a very wildly different style photographer to you, but I heard this story that David Bailey has a rule that when he shoots someone, whoever it is, whether it's the Queen or, you know, a man in the street, he insists that they come completely alone and they're not allowed to bring their agent or their manager or their PR or anyone. And if they do turn up with somebody else, then they're just sent away and the shoot doesn't happen. And that's his sort of terms.
Well, obviously, I tell people it's not a circus act, you know, when I'm photographing people. So I don't really enjoy an audience. But I've never said you can't bring your friend or whoever, or your dog, or your manager, you know. But I remember I did a shoot at Billy Idol in the early 90s in LA, and it involved writing something on a piece of glass and stuff. And he wasn't sure, and he had to call the manager, and he came over to judge it first before I could photograph it. And so,
because he wasn't sure about the way he'd written it, or he just didn't know about the concept behind it?
The concept, you know, seemed alien to him, I think.
Okay.
But it's a very good picture in the end.
Yeah.
And they let me photograph it, but it's, you know, managers also feel that they need to warrant their role sometimes, which is annoying.
We have a magazine as well, and we do a lot of our own photo shoots. And it's obviously a completely different world to the one that you started shooting in. For all of these reasons we're talking about, and, you know, people not being sure of things and everybody maybe wanting to look cool. And I understand it as well.
Me too, because you see what people call themselves photographers these days. It's awful.
Yeah.
So I don't blame people to check it out a bit. Yeah.
There's a great photo that you took of you two all in drag, I think.
Oh, yeah.
What year would that have been, that photo?
That would have been 91.
Okay. Obviously, you've got a very, very close relationship with that band now, and probably did already at that point.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did it just come down to that? Were they game for that? Because that, to me, what's amazing about that photo, other than the photo itself, is the fact that you got that band to do that.
Well, I think we all wanted to move away from the Joshua Tree and Rattle Hum kind of honest kind of
yeah.
look. And the music also was very changing with Achtung Baby. It was a very different kind of record. So this signaled a change in musical direction, and I wanted to follow that up with the photography. So we just went any direction. You know, we did a lot of different kind of shoots, and that was one of them. And dressing up, we did it during Carnival on one of the islands in Spain or Portugal. So it didn't seem so odd in that sense, doing it there, because everybody was dressed up outside. You know, it was also the fun element of that not being expected of you too.
I mean, it's true, isn't it? Like, the greatest photos are the ones, I think, where artists or actors or whoever's in the photo is kind of fully trusted the vision of the photographer doing it.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, you two also knew that if the pictures didn't turn out well, they would never be seen anywhere. But I also did a shoot with the Stones once for Rolling Stone magazine during the Voodoo Lounge album era. And I said, okay, I'd like to do it, but I'd like to bring some mask, you know, too, because I didn't like the Stones pictures of the 80s and 90s, because it was so safe, you know, all in studios. And I liked the Stones in the 60s and 70s when they took risk, and they were exciting pictures. So I wanted to hark back to that period. And then it went through some PR person, and they said, no way. I said, well, fine, but then don't expect me to fly to Canada to do a shoot that I don't want to do. And then Mick called me and said, what's this thing with the mask? So I explained it to him, voodoo and all that. And he said, okay, just bring the mask. So I did, and they did the pictures, and it was very successful for them.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for less. And for a limited time, new customers receive their second month free when they sign up and use promo code MONTHFREE by May 31st. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Taxes, fees, and other third-party charges will apply. See website for additional details.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
When it comes to your job, you're likely well-versed, but what about your skin? Life's busy enough. It doesn't have to be a big chore to get well-versed skin. Check out the dermatologist-tested cruelty-free vegan skincare products from Verst. It's under $25 and available at your local Target store, making it easier than ever to take care of your skin from head to toe. Podcast listeners, here's an exclusive deal. 15% off at verseedskin.com with code MEDIA15. That's verseedskin.com with code MEDIA15. Verst, available at Target.
I mean, that sort of high contrast black and white photography that you do, it's got this gothic feel to it. But one thing I wanted to ask you was, a lot of the artists that you've photographed, and the list is kind of obscene of the amount of the sort of legends, I guess, that you've photographed. But a lot of them are quite sort of these dark, brooding characters as well, from Nick Cave, Patti Smith. I've got a list here, Tom Waits, Depeche Mode, obviously, Joy Division. They're all these sort of dark, introspective characters. Are you attracted to shooting those types of people rather than the Spice Girls, say?
I wouldn't mind shooting Spice Girls, but I think that I veer towards people who gave everything for what they're doing, because I did the same in my photography. So there was that kind of link or desire to photograph people that felt they put everything into their work. I'm attracted to that.
That's a really good way to sum up all of those people I've just mentioned.
I guess. But there's also a practical thing. It was that when I started photography, the people I photographed in the magazines that I knew were all printed in black and white. And I thought the only way to get your pictures published in these magazines is if you make them in black and white. And same with Joy Division. I shot it in black and white because my only chance of publishing one of these pictures was in magazines that wrote about these bands that had no hits.
Of course.
And they were all printed in black and white. The Enemy was, in the early days, only black and white.
Yeah. I hadn't even thought about that.
Joy Division had a hit after Ian died. And then you would photograph it in color to publish it in smash hits. But we never got that far.
Yeah, and I suppose that's the other thing, isn't it? Like, hindsight's a wonderful thing. And those photos that you took of Joy Division now are legendary, iconic photos of an iconic band.
They weren't at the time. There was nothing logic about what I did.
Yeah. At the time when you went and introduced yourself to them, they weren't the world-renowned Joy Division. They were just a punk band that you liked.
Yeah, post-punk band, yeah.
Post-punk band that you're into. In your career, where does film and getting into like music videos and then films, was that just a natural progression for you to from photography?
In retrospect, it was, but it wasn't natural to me at all because I was shy, and I find that sharing ideas or being forced to come up with ideas for a video was not natural to me because I'm intuitive kind of photographer, and I'm very influenced by documentary photography. So I have to find something, but to plan it in advance, that's very hard for me. But what happened was that I did pick people's photographs for press and then also sometimes for album sleeves. And then said, well, these days we need one more thing, and that's a music video. Why don't you do that too? So that's how that started, reluctantly. And then I found my form actually only, I think, with Depeche Mode, because there was no budget.
Would that be in Enjoy the Silence?
No, that was way before that. That was for Question of Time, 86. And it was such a low budget that I had to shoot myself, the film myself. And then it became slightly more a moving experience. Before that, it was basically a selection of photographs put together to make it look like a
film. Enjoy the Silence, what's your starting point for that? Because it's the one with Dave Garn walking around with the deck chair and the king.
As a king, yeah. He's dressed as a king and walks around to the deck chair, yeah. Well, it was difficult. I'd done, by the time, I think, 5 videos for Depeche Mode in black and white. And all on Super 8, I all filmed myself. Then the first single that came off that album called Violator was Personal Jesus, which I'd done in color in black, on Super 8 in Spain. And then the second was Enjoy the Silence. And I only had this idea of this king walking with a deck chair through landscapes. And all he needed was peace and silence and sitting somewhere, looking at things we all can achieve. That doesn't matter if you have money or not. And I came back with the idea to the band, and they didn't like it. I couldn't visualize it. And I have to admit that I was really bad in describing my ideas. So that didn't help. And they said, could you please think of another idea? Because we think the song is so beautiful, one of the best things we've ever done. And so I went back, and then I couldn't get the idea I had out of my head. And there was no space to get another idea. And so I went back with the same thing. I said, I think it's really good, this idea. And they went like, okay, just do it. That kind of attitude. And it was, I think, £20,000 or something. The whole idea, it was shot in 2 locations in Portugal, 1 location in Switzerland and 1 in Scotland. And then the rest in my little studio in London, the black and white stuff. So it was a tiny team, you know.
It sort of comes back down to that trust thing again, right? You'd been working with them for so long. Yeah. That even when they didn't like the idea, they were like, okay, let's go. Were they happy with it in the end?
Oh, amazing. Because the feedback, once it was on MTV in America, was enormous. You know, it was incredible. And Chris Martin loved it so much, he wrote a song about it, about the video called Viva La Vida.
What I love about that video is that sort of color saturation. There's an echo of that in Heart-Shaped Box.
Yeah, but that's achieved in a very different way.
But that, I rewatched that video yesterday knowing I was meeting you. It's so iconic. You know, we like the film Squaring a Circle, one of the things that's so great about that is how iconic all the things that are being spoken about, all of those brilliant pieces of artwork. But that, you know, you've sort of got your own canon of that as well. And Heart-Shaped Box, I think, is up there. You know, it's one of those sort of very iconic moments of the 90s. So that was your idea as well, that concept?
No.
It was not? Okay.
No. Kurt came up with that idea. He made drawings and wrote things, and he faxed them to me. And I added a couple of things to it. But the whole genesis of that was his idea. And he was fantastic with that. He was a great artist, Kurt. And we made the film, and he wanted to have this Technicolor look, which we couldn't get because Technicolor didn't exist anymore. Mm. So we shot in color, then transferred it to black and white, and then cut some people in Mexico, just across the border, because we edited in San Diego, to hand tint every single frame. It took weeks and weeks and weeks. But the result was very beautiful.
Yeah, it gives it such a sort of disturbing, beautiful quality to it.
Yeah, which is great, because I had some videos but MTV turned down because they were too, didn't fit their guidelines or whatever. But because of the nice color, they never looked at the embryos hanging in trees. You know, no problem. It's so weird, isn't it?
Sleight of hand.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Was it a cheery shoot? Because it's such a sort of haunting video.
Yeah, but you know, it was a really great shoot until the old man, he collapsed on the cross. We thought it was a different thing. He had a bowel cancer or something he didn't know about, and that broke.
Wow.
And it was really heavy, and had to get the ambulance in. And they thought they were arriving at a snuff scene.
I bet they did.
Yeah, it was weird coming to that set with a cross and all that.
Are you tired of your scented cleaning products smelling and cleaning like meh? Then it's time for an upgrade with the power of Clorox Scentiva. With an uplifting scent that smells like coconut, Clorox Scentiva gives you powerful clean like Clorox, but a feeling like being transported to a tropical island retreat. Imagine putting your phone on Do Not Disturb, tuning out all the constant, just the feeling of warm sand in between your toes and a fruity drink in your hand. The ones with the little umbrella. Refresh your home to feel like an all-inclusive vacation by getting Clorox Scentiva. Also available in grapefruit and lavender scents at a nearby retail store.
When it comes to your job, you're likely well-versed, but what about your skin? Life's busy enough. It doesn't have to be a big chore to get well-versed skin. Check out the dermatologist-tested, cruelty-free vegan skincare products from Verst. It's under $25 and available at your local Target store, making it easier than ever to take care of your skin from head to toe. Podcast listeners, here's an exclusive deal. 15% off at VERSEDskin.com with code MEDIA15. That's VERSEDskin.com with code MEDIA15. Verst, available at Target.
Hi, I'm Giancarlo Esposito, and I'm here to introduce you to my character, Gray Parrish, from my new series, Parrish.
Yeah, I can drive.
My character was a getaway driver.
Yeah!
I'm retired from life, you know that.
His business is failing, his house is going up for sale. He is the everyman.
Tell me about this driver job.
We got a lot of action in this show. We have moments of real danger, and we want to feel as if anything could happen. Gray is invited to drive for this man. He's invited to make money, and he quickly realizes this is not the right thing to do.
I did what you told me to.
And he's in a world over his head.
Now, let's go!
He will try to do what's right and seek justice.
Parrish, all new Sundays at 9 on AMC and stream on AMC Plus.
I'm wary of time because I know it's limited. One thing I was going to ask you about Depeche Mode. I am from Essex myself.
Okay.
My dad lives in Basildon.
Oh, wow.
Did the band ever take you there at any point?
I went there for the first shoot I did with them.
Yeah.
In a pond in rowing boats.
Okay.
In 81.
I was going to ask you about what you thought about Basildon, but I won't.
Don't.
What was that the first time did you meet them? Because that is a band that has been a huge part of your life, and that relationship with them is...
Yeah, reluctantly. Because I was the head photographer for the enemy, the chief photographer. So I got all these assignments. And as it was a weekly magazine, the turnover was huge. I was asked to do the cover with Depeche Mode, so I did. And then Mute Records asked me to work with them for some other stuff, and I turned it down. It is too poppy for me. And they asked me twice in the next few years. After
this is when Depeche Mode are doing Can't Get Enough, that era.
Yeah.
When they were really poppy, you know, that was that very poppy. That pop thing.
And now I love these songs, but not then. And I don't know, I was reluctant to like these songs. But I only started with them when the video had to be done for Question of Time. And the stipulation was that it had to be done in America because they were on tour. That's the only reason I said yes, because I never, by the time, done a video in America. I didn't care who it was for, you know. So I did that video, and I didn't hear back from them at all because they all had gone on holidays by the time the video was finished. And then 9 months later, I got a call saying, we're working on new material. Would you mind coming and listen to it? So then I was asked to do another video. And then that was all before I did photography for them.
When they said they were working on new material and you went and heard it, had it changed? Had it got more into your liking at that point?
Or yes, totally.
Wasn't still the pop stuff?
No, it became, you know... That became the Violator album, and that was fantastic. So I started then with Strange Love, and then Never Let Me Down Again, and then Behind the Wheel. Yeah, great songs.
How then does a film like The American come about and fit into your world? Because I actually didn't know that was your film until yesterday. And retrospectively now, it does make sense having seen it and the style of it. But that is sort of seems so far away from everything that you've done, I guess.
Yeah, I just slowly, I guess, moved into more things that are an experience for me. After Control, I got all these other music bios offered. And I thought, I'm not going to go that direction. You know, if I do another film at all, which I never thought I would, because I thought Control is the one film I might be able to make. Because of all the awards it got so much attention. I got an agent and all that stuff. And then I got this script called A Very Private Gentleman, I think it was called. It was a very English book. But I thought, well, I don't want to work again with English actors because I've done that. But I do want to make something that's fictional because I want to have a very different experience. I don't want the Control film to be a lucky break, you know. I want to see if I actually can make a film about other things. So I went into color. We wanted an American actor to have that experience. And like I said, I wanted it to be a fictional story. So I changed some things. I actually wanted to make a Western, but I put some Western elements into that film. And, you know, I looked what I could do, and George was interested to work with me. So.
And did you enjoy the experience of, because that's obviously not just you and a camera or you and one assistant, that's a huge team and you're in charge of this huge moving thing. And you'd obviously done that on Control as well. It's obviously...
So there was a transition in a way, Control, because it was smaller and it felt more, something I had a handle on. Also financially, all my money went into that film, which I still don't have back because there was some other irregularities there. But this was a proper American studio film, you know. So it was quite a different experience. And I wanted to have that experience. I wanted to see if I could actually function that way. And there's some bits that I think, okay. But overall, I'm very happy with it. And it's also the kind of film nobody makes anymore. So I think that's quite beautiful about it.
Did you enjoy it?
Yes, I mean, I find it very stressful, to be honest. Mm. But it's also, I think about it with real love because you spent a few months in one place. And that was Abruzzo in Italy, which is a great place. You know,
Beautiful.
So you never have that with photography. You go in and out of all kind of places. But here you stay in a long time somewhere. You rent something to stay in, yeah.
Well, I loved it. And I loved the new film. And Anton, thanks very much for coming on Midnight Chats.
Stuart, thanks. My pleasure.
Midnight Chats is a joint production between Loud and Quiet and Atomized Studios for iHeartRadio.
It's hosted by Stuart Stubbs and Greg Cochran, mixed and mastered by Flo Lines, and edited by Stuart Stubbs.
Find us on Instagram and TikTok to watch clips from our recordings and much, much more. We are Midnight Chats Pod.
For more information, visit loudandquiet.com.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
When it comes to your job, you're likely well-versed, but what about your skin? Life's busy enough. It doesn't have to be a big chore to get well-versed skin. Check out the dermatologist-tested, cruelty-free vegan skincare products from Verst. It's under $25 and available at your local Target store, making it easier than ever to take care of your skin from head to toe. Podcast listeners, here's an exclusive deal. 15% off at VERSEDskin.com with code MEDIA15. That's VERSEDskin.com with code MEDIA15. Verst, available at Target.
You're a growing business, which means you need every spare hour you can find. That's why the most successful growing businesses are working together in Slack. Slack is where work happens, with all your people, data, and information in one AI-powered place. Start a call instantly in huddles and ditch cumbersome calendar invites. Or build an automation with Workflow Builder to take routine tasks off your plate. No coding required. Grow your business in Slack. Visit slack.com to get started.